It is Sunday night into Monday morning, which means we do the Monday morning movie reviews. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress. Let me say hello to Eric. Eric, hello.
Hello.
And Steve, hello.
Hey there.
Hey. Steve, you're over there at the Music Box Theater. You guys have the 70mm festival happening. Tell us all about that.
Yeah, we just finished up our first weekend, which just was killer, and it's probably our most popular film festival. We do it about every year and a half, and we just pull out, we go in search of 70mm prints that maybe we've never played before, or a few that we have that people seem to love, and then of course we always pull out our personal print of 2001: A Space Odyssey, which we purchased a couple years ago, and that seems to be probably the most consistently popular one that we play. But this year we're doing we're bringing back stuff like Interstellar and Life Force, and even just Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which was a huge success for us. We're bringing back Roma for a couple screenings, and Tron, and of course West Side Story, getting people ready for that Spielberg remake. And then we got a couple new ones which we've never played before, like Hello Dolly and the Charlton Heston film Khartoum. And I actually went yesterday to go see Last Action Hero, which we've never played before. And we're also doing, and actually I don't think Last Action Hero ever played in 70 in Chicago, so technically a Chicago premiere. And we're bringing the Untouchables next week, so in the second week. So it's just so much fun. The images are still, like, these prints are amazing so far. The images are crystal clear. You're seeing details you would just never see otherwise. And the sound is amazing. We can listen to it on the new sound system. So, yeah, but I mean, I strongly recommend, if there's something you're really excited about seeing, get a ticket early, because some of these are really crowded. So, yeah. And I think someone told me we've sold more full festival passes than we ever have before this year.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. And people can go to the Music Box website to get the schedule.
Absolutely.
And all that stuff,
right? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, it's cool. All there.
All right. And Eric, you are going to be hosting a screening of The Hunt for Red October on March 11th, correct?
Yeah, this Wednesday at the Elk Grove Cinema. It's the first time we've been doing this for many years. This is the first time we've had an online poll. We gave people a choice of a couple different movies of what they would like to see on the big screen, and the vote spoke to Hunt for October. So I will be hosting that screening at 7 o'clock Wednesday night, and there are also matinee shows at 1 and 4 if people just want to come and see the movie and don't want to hear me prattle on about it. But, you know, come to the 7 o'clock show. We'll have a blast and talk about submarine movies.
As you know, every submarine movie is good, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I love all submarine movies. I can't believe Hunt for Red October is 30 years old.
Yeah, almost to the day. It opened in March of 1990.
I feel like, wow, I'm 106, I swear.
Wow.
I mean,
yeah.
Wow. 30 years ago that movie came out. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. it's a good one too, man. Hunt for Red October is a submarine movie, so officially
right.
It's good. But a 30th anniversary, Elk Grove Cinema. And you
yep.
said there's a 1 o'clock and a 4 o'clock matinee, and then there's a 7 o'clock screening.
Correct.
All right, cool. All right, Steve, tell us about Burden.
Oh, boy. Okay, so in the last few years, I feel like I've seen a handful of films that attempt to, like, illustrate or at least make a case for the redeemability of white supremacists. And the belief is that some series of connections with the people they would suppress, and coupled with maybe some faith-based revelation or run-in with somebody that turns out better than they thought, or the love of a good woman or whatever it is, that somehow this can set a series of events going that will redeem them somehow. And many of these films, like last year, we had a couple. Like, we had this one called Best of Enemies with Sam Rockwell, which was based on a historical event. And then there's another one which actually played at our festival called Skin, starring Jamie Bell, that was, I believe, fictional. But anyway, that it just seems strange to me that at a time when even our own president is making a case that, you know, you have good people on both sides, that I don't see the need for a movie like this. But why should audiences care if a supremacist can get turned to good and shown the error of his ways? Anyway, so apparently I'm not the only one that feels this way, because this film, Burden, was actually at the Sundance Film Festival 2 years ago, right, Eric? And it won an audience award in the drama category. And Andrew, writer-director Andrew Heckler, who's an actor-turned-director, this is his directing debut, he opts to tell a story of a Ku Klux Klan member named Mike Burden, who's played by Garrett Hedlund, who was raised practically from birth in South Carolina in an atmosphere of hate and segregation, and under the mentorship of a Klan leader played by Tom Wilkinson, who has sort of turned this shuttered small-town movie theater into the country's first redneck store and KKK museum. The very presence of this establishment, not surprisingly, is inflammatory to the local black population, who immediately begin organizing protests under the leadership of a Baptist preacher named Kennedy, who's played by Forrest Whitaker. Burden helps run the store, and Griffin is so impressed with his enthusiasm about it that he turns over the lease to him at one point, making certain that he'll take it over eventually. Around this time, Burden also meets a single mother named Judy, who's played by the wonderful Andrea Riceborough, who initially knows that Mike is a Klan affiliated, but chooses to sort of ignore it as long as it doesn't impact her young son. But eventually she does give him the ultimatum and says, like, the Klan or us. And Burden goes with his heart. So everyone feels mushy about him.
Okay, anyway, Steve, hang on one second.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, Eric and Steve are here, and the movie reviews continue on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline Studio here until 4 a.m. We have Walter's perspective coming up. We will also talk about some of the phrases that you will only hear in Chicago. Beavis and Butthead debuted on this date, and we'll talk about some animated series. Marcus Leshock, our good friend from over at WGN-TV, is going to join us a little bit later on. And my dad's going to tell a joke because it's Monday, or it will be Monday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And Eric Childress and Steve Procopio are here for the movie reviews and the box office. Okay, Steve, before the break, you were talking about a film called Burden.
So Burden's really two movies. So we kind of track Mike's struggle to break free of this sort of Klan family that he's known most of his life. And then we also follow the path of Reverend Kennedy and his family and congregation, who insists that the only way to win over your enemy is not with violence, but with love. Their paths don't really cross until late in the film when Mike basically doesn't have a job anymore. He loses his job. He loses his house. And Kennedy spots the family of three, and invites them to come to his home and live with him, which sends shockwaves through the community, most of whom know who Burden is pretty well, unfortunately, for the worst of reasons. And like I said at the beginning, I'm basically done giving racist Southerners a chance, even just those in the movies. I'm at a loss why I'm supposed to care about the road to redemption these people take, when there are sort of tens of thousands of other stories of those they have wronged that are probably much more interesting and poignant and don't come with some sort of weird promise of a happy ending. Burden is, I guess, competently made. And like I said, Forrest Whitaker and Andrew Riceborough are very good in the film. I don't know what Garrett Hedlund's doing in this movie. He's got some sort of weird swagger thing going on. He can't seem to control the muscles in his neck. I'm not sure. Anyway, but like, I consider a great deal of the American South a lost cause at this point, so I'm not really that interested in watching these movies. I was willing to give this a shot, but I don't think it's a story worth telling, and it might be beyond my capacity to forgive at this point. So anyway, not a recommendation.
Okay. All right. So that's Burden, which is out right now. All right. Eric, tell us about Run This Town.
Okay. Well, this is a film that I saw at, last year's South by Southwest Film Festival. And it's a story of Ben Platt plays a young, out of college guy who's looking to find work as a journalist. And he finds work at kind of a way I remember, it's kind of a smaller Toronto-based paper. And while he wants to sort of be writing about, you know, the really big stories as any new reporter wants to do, he finds himself sort of, you know, doing like clickbait stuff and things like that. And then he, you know, when he finally gets the opportunity, he basically finds out that maybe he's not as good a writer as, you know, he has sort of propped himself up to be. But then he gets an opportunity when he comes across hearing the stories involving a certain mayor in Toronto by the name of Rob Ford. Now, the interesting thing about Rob Ford, people may remember this is the Toronto mayor who is scandal-plagued throughout the back part of his career and was actually caught on camera smoking crack. And in the movie, he is played by Damian Lewis.
I remember you telling me about this movie. And when I heard that Damian Lewis played Rob Ford, I was like, what?
Yeah, and if people remember what Rob Ford looked like and know what Damian Lewis looks like, let's just say it was a lot more believable when he played Steve McQueen for 2 minutes in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood than as Rob Ford. And it's not even so much Damian Lewis's fault as the fault of the makeup artist who basically make him look like Fat Bastard from Austin Powers, which is really kind of unfortunate. I remember the makeup not being particularly good. So hence you have this, you know, mostly sort of quasi-fictional retelling of how these stories began to get out about Rob Ford, not just the things that I mentioned, but also sexual harassment around the office. Nina Dobrev plays a woman, an assistant in the office, who may be a victim of that. But when I say quasi-fictional, I mean there's so many probably very interesting stories about the actual Rob Ford if he was the center of the movie, which he is most decidedly not. This is more about the sort of generational thing about all the people who are trying to do the right thing, are ham-fisted by the fact that they need jobs and they need money and they need social standing. Knowing that this Ben Platt's character is not really the guy that he, you know, purports to be, is kind of an interesting angle. And hearing his superiors at the place played by Scott Speedman, I think Jennifer Ellie is another one. Hearing them talk to him, they represent authority in this movie, and that was far more interesting. And the movie, what I remember, had this. They're really trying to really just kind of do a lot of overlapping dialogue and really kind of trying to elevate it to a level of almost like Armando Iannucci in a way, and to try, not in a comic way, but in really just trying to, you know, get all these characters in a room and each have them something interesting to say when really it's not. It's a director really sort of overreaching his boundaries. It's an interesting attempt, but it ultimately just did not work for me.
Okay, that's Run This Town, which is out right now. All right, Steve, tell us about Wendy.
Yeah, one of the most anticipated films at the Sundance Film Festival this year, Wendy, is the latest work from Beast of the Southern Wild filmmaker Ben Zeitlin. It's his first movie, actually, in 7 years since that groundbreaking Oscar-nominated film, and he's kind of sticking with these sort of loose themes of stories of childhood told through the lens of magical realism. He co-wrote the film with his sister Eliza, and it's kind of a passion project for him. And he's taking on nothing short of the legend of Peter Pan as perceived through the very modern eye of a young Louisiana girl named Wendy, who's played by newcomer Devin France, although technically everyone in the film, I think, is a newcomer. It's fascinating the way the Zeitlins have kind of deconstructed the Peter Pan mythology and pieced it back together in sort of unexpected and very different ways sometimes than we're used to seeing this childhood story of these kids that never want to grow up. Wendy and her brothers are sort of seduced into this lifestyle by Peter, who travels on these old rail lines looking for children desperate to get out of their homes. And Wendy and her brothers hate that they're growing up poor and with few prospects of escaping their lives. So the idea of running off seems really appealing, and they get to this sort of exotic desert island that I guess is Neverland, and seemingly occupied by only wild children. All sort of sense of time and space vanishes, and they even seem to forget where they're from and what their real names are. And this place is run by Peter, who's played by a really magnetic young kid named Joshua Mack, who sort of waxes poetic about staying young forever as long as you truly believe that you want to do it. And if you even entertain the idea that staying young is bad, you start to age pretty rapidly, like a curse. It's kind of crazy. One of the more interesting new ideas Zeitlin is bringing to the story is that the pirates are actually just kids who doubted and grew up really fast. They're all kind of failed children, and it makes them angry and want to take revenge on the kids that actually get to stay young. The greatest achievement in the film is Wendy, and she's just kind of a really magnetic, wild, but knowing kid. I will fully admit I have a low tolerance for films about out-of-control kids, and Wendy is pretty much populated by nothing but that. So for a while at the beginning, I was being sort of slowly driven insane by this movie and certain aspects of it. But once Wendy kind of goes from this carefree life on the island to one where she's actually attempting to, like, save her family and doubt the whole idea of staying young forever, I found the whole thing much more tolerable in the second half. I was intrigued by this idea that that we're not necessarily supposed to see Peter as a hero. Maybe he might even be a villain. He's a little scary. He's a little intimidated. He's certainly a jerk in this story. Anyone who leaves Peter Pan thinking Peter cares only about himself may finally have gotten the point of this entire journey. There's a lingering sort of sense of melancholy that permeates a great deal of it, and it may be there because the ultimate lesson is that never growing up isn't the dream that Peter and his friends attempt to convince us it is. It's treated as a temptation more than a solution, and the Zeitlins are both sort of in awe of these children and slightly terrified of their desire not to join the rest of us in aging and maturing and be productive members of society. There are parts of this film that are very otherworldly and visually masterful, but sometimes it's also very scattered and jittery and disjointed. The wonder of working with first-time actors can be really fun, but it's also a curse sometimes, and there are sometimes when the kids are asked to emote and it just doesn't work. There's a little bit of a lack of focus and through line that Beasts of the Southern Wild certainly did have in much better ways. I think I admired the work more than I enjoyed it, and that sort of keeps it from achieving anything close to greatness. I actually definitely wasn't in the mood to see it at Sundance. I had to go back and see it again more recently, so I was at least able to appreciate certain parts of it, but I can't quite recommend it.
Okay. You guys, hang on a second. We'll get Eric's thoughts on Wendy as well as the Nick DiGilio show continues. Nick DiGilio show here on 720 WGN, continuing on this Sunday night into Monday morning. Monday morning meaning my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. We have a Blackhawks Express from the game earlier tonight, and we got a lot more to talk about here on the show. Right now, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress are here talking about the new movies. And before we heard what Steve thought of the movie Wendy. And Eric, what did you think?
I didn't like it. And the longer the movie went on, and this movie is quite long, I was even more restless than Steve was during the first half of it. We saw the movie together at Sundance. I think we were probably both pretty restless during that screening. But the longer the movie went on, and the more I was trying to sort of grasp Zeitlin with the story, the more it just dawned on me, it's just like he did this movie already called Beasts of the Southern Wild, and is basically, in many respects, you know, the same basic movie, a movie about this group of people that sort of are kind of isolated, and they have their own society in a way. They don't want to join, the regular part of the world. And then also this conflict between, the daughter and the father, and how growing old kind of sucks sometimes, especially when you get sick. And that led to an incredibly emotional conclusion in that film. It was one of my favorite films of that year. And this one, he just happens to be doing it with Peter Pan. And while I think that the girl that plays Wendy is pretty good in the film, it's one of the more beautiful, ugly films that I can remember seeing in some time. I remember this being a criticism back in the day of Spielberg's Hook about how Neverland didn't quite have the right colors and whatnot. This film is all browns, and it's just not a pleasant to look at. You know, even though the cinematography is strikingly beautiful at times, and the longer it went on, and he's sort of using the same type of score that we heard in Beast to a bit, and by the time it was all over, I'm just like, I really don't need to see another version of Peter Pan. I don't care what interpretation it is for a long time.
Okay. All right, so that's Wendy, which is out now. All right, Eric, tell us about The Way Back.
Okay, this is the repairing of Ben Affleck with his accountant director, Gavin O'Connor, and he plays called a functioning alcoholic who's divorced from his wife, and gets a call one day or a meeting with a priest that works at the school where he went to school many years ago and was actually a star basketball player. Their basketball coach has taken up ill, and they need a replacement in the middle of their really poor season right away. And he comes to him, thinks of him, would be a good replacement for him. While he's reluctant, more than a bit reluctant to begin with, he does take the job. Is there to whip these kids into shape and, go through each of them individually and tell them what their strengths and their weaknesses are. And aspects of this, we have seen in sort of, probably every underdog story that we've seen over time. And, there are some parallels to Hoosiers here that people think of when they draw parallel directly to another basketball movie. But this is not the typical basketball movie that you might think. While the basketball scenes even themselves, not exactly filmed, as real sort of big spectacle, pieces of sort of cinematic excitement. They sort of look like if you're really just kind of close up watching, people play basketball. And I think that, while it's not as exciting to watch that aspect of it, I think that might be part of the point because the games so much are not as what's important about the story as the Ben Affleck's character, who, for the course of much of the movie, like I mentioned, is a functioning alcoholic. He drinks. He has a regular job aside from the basketball job that he takes on, and happily goes out with his friends and drinks and has good nights, has bad nights, but is piecing together some past trauma that we learn about throughout the course of the movie, and it leads to some really powerful, very poignant moments with Affleck. Affleck as an actor, we've seen time and time again, and has often, sometimes he can be somewhat of a punchline, for certain roles that he's taken, Batman and things like that. But when Affleck is really at his best, it's usually a role that really sort of takes advantage of what is really this sort of this no BS approach. And he's really at his strongest here in The Way Back. Probably, certainly the best he's been since, like, his directorial efforts, like The Town and Argo. He's really really strong here, and it's certainly the reason to see this movie. And it's going to surprise a lot of people, the directions that this story takes. In some ways, it's almost like an underdog story in reverse. And don't let people spoil some of the aspects of what's going on with this character, because some of it, really hit me on a certain level that I found really quite striking. This movie really surprised me, and Gavin O'Connor had some ups and downs through his career. I was not a particular fan of The Accountant, but he seems to be really at his best when dealing with stories around sports. This is the guy that also directed The Really Great Warrior with Joel Edgerton and Tom Hardy, and the great Nick Nolte, who was nominated for that movie, as well as Miracle, a great 1980 United States hockey team movie with Kurt Russell. Those movies are on another level overall, but this one it worked quite well for me, and a lot of it is due to Ben Affleck's performance.
Okay. Steve, what'd you think?
Yeah, I think it's terrific. The interesting thing about the film and the dirty little secret is it's not about a basketball team that gets whipped into shape and starts winning games. It's about this guy's road to recovery. And the team is sort of part of it, but it's not the whole thing. It might sound like a cliche, but like Eric said, Jack is using booze to dull a pain that destroyed his life, basically. The scenes, there's some little things in here that just really sell this movie for me. The scenes of Ben Affleck at this local dive bar, and it's a gross little bar. He's a mess, and he has all these like gross people around him, and they're some of the best scenes in the movie because it's really easy to believe that this is what the life this guy lives, and Ben Affleck kind of knows a little bit about that, it sounds like. So when he attempts to quit drinking on his own, it only works for a little while, and before long he's sort of sneaking alcohol in his little coffee travel mug, and there are some fantastic supporting performances. I really like Michaela Watkins as his barely tolerant sister. Al Madrigal plays the assistant coach, and he's so good in this. And then there's this young actor, Brandon Wilson, who plays the team's sort of shy star player, whom Jack kind of helps shape into a team leader that's really, really great. I think the games are shot really well, but again, like we do get a sense of how he's coaching them and impacting the play, but there's not like a big game moment at the end. And in fact, the film shifts so completely into telling Jack's story that I don't think you're even going to miss what happens with the team. Like, you're not going to care as much about that. Oh, we certainly do find out, but we kind of have this sense that Jack has taught them well enough to play, and we don't have to worry about that. This, like I said, goes into this idea that Jack has to understand that the only way out of this is through it and not going around it. And I was just so genuinely impressed with this movie.
All right. Okay. Eric and Steve are going to hang out with us. We got more movies to review. 312-981-7200 is the phone number.
Corn in the fields, and listen to the rice when the wind blows across the water. Cause she's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's
one. Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 4 a.m. Marcus Leshock from Channel 9, WGN TV, is going to join us a little bit later on. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We'll have some classic stand-up from The Tonight Show, The Johnny Carson Show, which you can see every night on Antenna TV. Louis Anderson from 1984. 312-981-7200, that's the phone number. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi are here. We're talking about the movies. All right, Steve, tell us about Onward.
Yes, hey, it's the latest from Pixar. Here we go. It begins with a look back in history, not our history, but the history of a fantasy world where all manner of sort of mermaids and unicorns and elves and fairies and minotaurs and wizards and just about any other creature you might find in a role-playing game would exist. But as these fantasy beings find shortcuts to doing magic over time, like why use your wings to fly when you can buy an airplane ticket, or why use a spell to start a fire when you can use a match, they become lazy and the magic that made them special starts to disappear from the world at large. So skip ahead to more or less the present day, and we meet Ian and Barley, who are two elf brothers voiced by Tom Holland and Chris Pratt. They grew up without their father because the father died just before the younger Ian was born, and when Barley was still a young elfling. Their mother, who's voiced by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, has done a great job of raising them, but that hasn't kept Ian from being frustrated at not having a dad. He kind of lacks confidence. He doesn't have a lot of friends and believes that having a father in his life might have changed that. Barley is a bit of a lovable lug who knocks everything over that's in his path, and he tries to stay connected to the magic world through role-playing games, and he drives this amazing van named Guinevere that he refers to as his mighty steed, and if you see the detailing on the side, you'll understand why. So when Ian turns 16, his mom gives him this very special present from his dad. It's a wizard staff that includes a built-in spell that is supposed to bring his father back to life for 24 hours. And Ian kind of botches the spell about halfway through, and only the bottom half of his father, basically just his pants, appear to him, very much alive and communicative, but without sort of ears and eyes and ways to communicate very well. Ian figures out that he needs something called a phoenix crystal to complete the spell, and Barley thinks this is a great opportunity to sort of pair up on a brotherly quest that ends with Ian sort of getting to spend this day with his dad that he's always dreamed of, and for Barley it's a chance to rediscover the magic that still exists in their world. The director, Dan Scanlon, who did Monsters University, which was definitely not one of my favorite Pixar films, has crafted what might be Pixar's purest adventure film, and he and the team have filled it with sort of laughs and action and a great deal of creativity. I really liked Octavia Spencer, this beastly creature that she plays named the Manticore, that's part lion and bat and scorpion, and she used to be the most feared and respected creature in the realm, and now she's managing just a theme restaurant. But between the laughs, Onward does what Pixar does best, which is to find that emotional core of the story, and by the end we realize the film isn't about this kid's search for his father. It's about this kid realizing and appreciating the people in his life that did raise him and did have a hand in shaping who he is. And, you know, if you have a sibling in your life that you're particularly close to, I'm going to guess you might cry like a baby in this movie. I don't know. But Onward also deals with issues of bullying and searching for inner confidence, and how real magic sometimes comes from just believing in that you can do something, even if you can't. So it sounds corny. It is corny sometimes. I think the energy that Holland and Pratt bring to these characters is really impressive, and they sort of sell that lifelong bond. It's genuinely moving. The sometimes manic performances carry over into the pacing of the film, which at times can be exhausting. But Onward finishes strong, I think, with a standoff between our heroes and a really interesting visual take on what I always think is a played-out creature in the fantasy world that needs some conquering in this film. The whole film is sort of hit and miss at times, but I think the final act delivers on its emotional promise and brings all things to a satisfying conclusion, at least. The movie sort of douses itself in color and imagination and a healthy dose of enthusiasm, I think, ends up winning the day.
Okay. Eric?
I was shockingly underwhelmed by this movie. The prologue of this movie that Steve described, this, you know, this idea that the magic has sort of gone out in the world and everyone's, you know, taking the easy way out. What a great setup for a movie. A movie that I knew very little about going in. As all I knew was sort of like an elven road trip movie with two brothers. And I thought that that was a pretty great setup. And the movie almost takes on that life, that it just seems that it gets lazy itself and just sort of forgets the really sort of really intriguing premise that it sets itself upon. But then as like the emotional undercurrent of this movie where they're trying to resurrect their dad for this very brief time in their lives, one of the brothers who didn't really know him at all, I was expecting a much bigger payoff at the end of the film, and for the bulk of the movie I was sort of tolerating this adventure story, which I really wish had only been the one brother. I really did not like the Chris Pratt brother character. I thought it was just, he just interrupted everything too often. I would much rather have been a solo story with the brother trying to reconnect with his father. There's this wonderful moment really early on in the movie where the younger brother has a tape of his father, and he knows the tape so well that he's able to craft a conversation with his father as a result of it. And I thought, well, what? I mean, that upped me in such a way that I'm just like, oh, I'm so set up for this movie now. And then it just became more of a routine adventure story with a couple nifty set pieces along the way. And then I was just waiting for this conclusion to really, at least I'm going to get that at the end. And I thought that they botched it too. The entire movie, I kept thinking about the ending to Steven Spielberg's AI, which seems to be where this movie almost gained that idea of resurrecting your most loved person for a single day and then never being able to speak to them ever again. And that movie destroys me. This movie left me very underwhelmed.
Yeah, I was underwhelmed by it too. It didn't have any. I didn't connect with it emotionally, and that's really odd for a Pixar movie, because most Pixar movies you connect on an emotional level. And I can't count the number of Pixar movies that have me crying. Usually it's at the end, but in the case of Up, it's the first 10 minutes.
Right.
But I didn't connect with these characters. I thought it was nicely animated. There are some clever things in it, and some of the action sequences are fun. But I never connected with it on any kind of emotional level. So I was disappointed with Onward as well. So it did make $40 million over the weekend, though,
which is not very good for a Pixar movie.
No.
No, this is down there. This is Good Dinosaur numbers.
Okay.
Yeah, and this is the first Pixar movie they've ever opened in March. It's always been either June, November, and a couple ones at the very end of May. So they have another one coming out in June. So I just don't know if they just didn't know where to put this movie, or they didn't think it was strong enough for a summer or a holiday release. But $40 million is not great for a movie of studio like Pixar.
Okay, all right. Invisible Man came in second with $15 million, up to about $53 million total. That's pretty solid.
Oh, it's almost it's going to be close to $100 million worldwide, and it only cost $7 million to make.
There you go, man. And then The Way Back, $8.5 million.
Which is not great, unfortunately.
Yeah. All right, what do we got next week?
Next week we got The Hunt. The Hunt is coming out.
Okay, and then
Bloodshot
and Vin Diesel and Bloodshot.
Bloodshot.
And then another Christian movie, Christian singer movie.
Okay.
I still believe.
All right. That's what we're looking forward to. Guys, thanks very much.
Yes.
Everybody go to the Music Box for the 70mm Festival as well. All right. There we go. There's Eric and Steve, and we'll do it again next week right here on 720 WGN.